I was literally helping design the trial, set up the studies, oversee those studies, understand how the drugs could be used better, working for biotech companies. And at the same time, you know, the next day I was going to the clinic and I would say, if this was possible, this is the way that medicine should be practiced.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Infectious disease physician, entrepreneur, and lifelong innovator, Diego Morales has pursued the frontiers of medicine on three continents and in at least three distinct settings, in academia, in biotech startups, and within the largest pharma company on earth. We are thrilled to have captured him briefly for our program today.
This is Tectonics. I'm Lisa Soonan.
I'm David Shaywitz, and today's episode is brought to you by DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. So, Lisa,
yes.
I was thinking about Diego's career path and his experiences at both startups and a huge pharma company, and it reminded me of Bob Kocher's recent Wall Street Journal op-ed, essentially arguing that small businesses can learn faster and adapt in a far more agile fashion than corporate behemoths.
Well, that is definitely true in my experience. I mean, a lot of the work I do is with the larger companies around innovation, and I often find that their eagerness to innovate is stopped by their inability to get past their bureaucracy to adopt. It's really a struggle.
Yeah, I mean, and that was very much the point that that Bob talked about in the journal op-ed. Although you hear of some companies that reportedly are more successful, they describe GE actually as an example where they very deliberately sort of incorporated more of a startup mindset throughout the culture.
Yep, I think that's true.
So, and I guess the real question is the degree to which medicine and healthcare is really actually even looking for agility and novelty versus reliability and familiarity. And there are few people better suited to jump into this discussion than today's guest, Diego Morales. Welcome to the program, Diego.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you guys.
All righty. Well, hope you feel that way at the end. there are so many topics that we're keen to discuss with you, but we want to be sure listeners know a bit more about your fascinating life story. As I understand it, you were born in Argentina, where you went to medical school. You came to Mayo for your medical residency, Cornell for your ID fellowship, then joined the faculty at Duke, where you are on the front lines of HIV care. You continue to take care of these patients even after you joined a local biotech startup. So my first question really for you is, did you always want to be a doctor, and then what happened?
Both my parents were physicians, like you, David, so we have that, we share history, and so I guess that I was destined to be a doctor. I debated between being a priest and a doctor, but I thought I would want to get married someday, being Catholic, and so therefore the clergy was not consistent with marital life, and therefore I decided to be a doctor.
Well, I'm sure your kids are appreciative.
I won't make any of the obvious comments about what the priests do anyway.
That was Lisa, not me, for the record. Send your mail to her.
So I was an idealistic young man then, okay? So I really wanted to serve. I mean, and for me, medicine was a vocation for service. And I got to do that, being an HIV physician. It was an unbelievable experience, you know, to witness a terrible modern epidemic with a lot of young people dying, in a terrible disease. And there were a lot of issues coming into that experience, because it was not only a medical crisis, but there were a lot of elements of societal values involved in the HIV epidemic. And so we were at the forefront, not only of medicine and science, but at the forefront of social changes. I would argue a lot of the social changes that we enjoy today and we take for granted were achieved. There were achievements from the suffering of a lot of people, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. And so we have to be thankful for HIV, not only for accelerating the understanding of immunology and molecular biology as it did, but also for accelerating changes in society that we are all enjoying today. Another element of HIV that I think is really important is that the advocacy that was exerted on HIV was extremely effective to actually get drugs to patients as early as possible. And I think that was also the third element of the incredible progress done through the HIV epidemic, is pushing regulatory authorities to make the patient at the forefront and to allow those patients to receive drugs earlier. And in many cases, a lot of people are alive today because of those changes.
You know, it's so interesting to think about that tension between social values and disease and drug approvals and dissemination. I mean, is there a corollary going on today at all? I'm sitting here thinking, you know, what is the disease today, or what is the challenge today that society is preventing, you know, for some period of time getting dealt with Zika? Maybe, I don't know. Is it perceived as a
Are there examples where you think more intensive patient advocacy could help remove some of the bureaucratic barriers associated with regulatory approvals?
Without a doubt. I think the issue is, where's the fine line between being able to conduct appropriate scientific studies to answer the questions as to the usefulness of a specific treatment, and being able to allow patients who have fatal conditions to take the necessary risks that only they can assess, you know, because it's their lives and they are the ones that are willing to take risks, you know, to change the course of their diseases. And so it's just that balance. We need to have appropriately controlled studies to be able to come up to conclusions on the usefulness of treatments. But at the same time, we have to help people try things that can help them. It's very hard to be academic or to be very very rigid when it comes to patients willing to take or to try new treatments to save their lives. I don't think that anybody can experience that unless you are the person who's dying.
Have you had experiences in your pharma, whether at a biotech or a larger company, where people have asked for compassionate use or have asked for exceptions, and you've been forced to decide whether or not they need whether or not you will authorize someone to get on a drug sort of off protocol?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, many calls of people that did not qualify, say, for an expanded access or for some of the criteria of clinical trials. And that's why, I mean, I think that Johnson & Johnson did something very novel, which is actually to create a third party made of experts and ethicists and physicians who would be able to determine the criteria under which patients could have compassionate use access to drugs, because otherwise you end up playing God, you know. I mean, it's not a good position to be in, because otherwise people who have more influence or who know somebody may have access to drugs when other patients don't. And I don't think that's fair. So I think that one has to try to create the fairest system with criteria that allows you to provide those drugs. And sometimes they are heart-wrenching decisions, because you are not allowed to give drugs to patients that you think could be helped by them, but you need a certain structure and rules, because otherwise it becomes quite chaotic.
And so, Diego, tell me, you know, back to our opening thoughts here, is it different at a small company versus a large company to deal with these issues? I mean, now you're at a startup. Can you as easily support, and I don't know if the relevance of your particular focus is the same here, but in general, can you deal with these issues and be as generous with a small company as you can with a large one?
Well, I mean, here comes two elements, all right? I think small or big, experience matters. And so people who have had these experiences have a different understanding or wisdom, and they can apply that to the procedures that are done in either company. So I don't think that large or big matters there. What matters is the economics, because for example, when we were fighting to beat HIV in the early 90s, 3TC was a drug that Glaxo was developing. That drug had 30,000 patients had access to that drug for free before it was approved.
Wow.
All right? I don't think that a small startup could afford to do that, but mostly for financial reasons. I mean, the infrastructure necessary to distribute and provide drugs before approval. So they had to be, you know, that you needed a clinical report form. I mean, you need a CRF to enter all that data. Effectively, it was a clinical trial. And to do that before approval, I'm not sure that a startup can afford to do that. So there's one is the, I would say, the element of experience on how to do it, what needs to be done, and how to administer. And the other one is the financial element. If we're talking about diseases that are much smaller, of course, that's possible either way. But when you're talking about very, very large medical needs, then a startup is at a disadvantage.
Here's a question for you, Diego. You were at, you saw Clint patients. You were, as you said, on the front lines of the HIV epidemic in North Carolina. Initially, as an academic, and then although you continued to see patients, you moved over to biotech. What was that experience like? What were you thinking, particularly with regard to having an impact on the disease? Because it sounds like you were really motivated to have an impact and were trying to figure out how best to do something for the patients who are suffering in your clinic.
I would say those years were, I would say as a doctor, they were the most thrilling years of my life. And I would say if this was possible, this is the way that medicine should be practiced, because I was literally, helping design the trial, set up the studies, oversee those studies, understand the adverse events, understand how the drugs could be used better through my hat, working for biotech companies. And at the same time, the next day I was going to the clinic and and understanding better about what was the needs. What needs were addressed or not, how the drugs needed to be better, how the patients could be identified that really would benefit the most from these drugs. So it was like I was really living in translation. I was living the exact translation between the lab and the clinic, and going literally going back and forth between them. So that was a thrilling time of my medical and scientific life. And I think if that were possible, I think we should have a lot more people doing that, because I think it would provide a lot more insights about how to design clinical trials, how to develop better drugs. Today is done through KOLs. That, we consult KOLs that tell us what's happening in the clinic.
Key opinion leaders.
And then we go back, key opinion leaders. So then we go back to the company. But I think if you have people that are doing both, I think that is the optimal.
So I understand what you're saying, that there was a lot of fluidity and sort of commonality of experience as you moved from Duke over to the biotech company. But what did surprise you? What was different about the business environment of pharma, compared to your experience in the clinical world?
I would say the biggest difference was between the academic world and the private sector of a biotech company, in that in the private sector, you are really focused on getting to success, in getting something done as quickly as possible. So, and at the time also remember that there was a certain urgency as well, because we knew that these drugs were badly needed. So there was an urgency on the unmet medical need. There was an urgency in that the resources in the private sector are generally limited, and so you have to optimize those resources and do things as quickly as possible. I would say that was the biggest contrast between the private sector and the academic sector, where the dynamics are different. It's a different world. I mean, one lives or dies by success, and success is only one thing. That's the big difference. In the success is really to get a drug approved. In the academic sector and in science, in the larger theme of science, the understanding of reality, the understanding of the truth, is really the success. And that can have any form. It doesn't matter whether things work out the way you thought they would or not, as long as you define reality and you better describe reality. In the private sector, success is only one. It's only one thing happening. And so that sets a completely different mentality in one way, in one place and the other. I think at the when you talk about the medical level, there's an element of contact with suffering that you don't have you don't get in the private sector. You know, the clinical care has an element of understanding of the realities of a patient, which is, you know, they are suffering physical, emotional, social, you know, all the privations that patients have, you know, I mean, the poverty of patients and how, you know, sometimes in the private sector, they oh, let's do this, let's do that. But if you are, you know, in clinical care, you realize that's not possible, that, you know, patients have other problems, that things are not black and white, that are really complicated in human beings' lives. So I think that what you miss in everything that is not clinical care is the realities of humanity.
So, Diego, just curious what you think about this. You know, as the healthcare system, the clinical world of treating patients is moving more and more to a financially structured, you know, bundled payment, value-based kind of model where even the clinicians have to be much more aware of the costs of things. Do you think that will separate them from some of those feelings and thoughts about the patient? Will they become more like the private sector in their behavior, or will they be able to stay more like the clinical side, you know, from whence they've come?
I think at many levels it already has, and the three of us have had many discussions around healthcare, and I think what we have today is maybe the worst of all worlds. There's tremendous financial pressures, and so medicine is all about money, about making, you know, ends meet and, you know, getting your quotas and, you know, getting the patients in and out. And so the patients, I mean, we have lost in clinical care the care where people can truly spend time and care for other people. And at the same time, I don't think that we are in a place where medicine is efficient either. I think that medicine remains incredibly inefficient, where fee-for-service is still alive and well, and, you know, with all the perversions of a fee-for-service system. So I think, honestly, right now, I think we have the worst of all worlds. We have a system that it just focuses on profits, or at least on making ends meet, because a lot of primary care physicians are really trying to make ends meet, and a system that is not really supportive emotionally of the patient, because that doesn't get paid.
Right. There's no DRG. There's no reimbursement code for giving it, you know?
For empathy, yeah. Or to put it in more, you know, professional terms.
Yeah, that's...
so I hope,
Dr. Shane,
I hope that right now we are in a transition to a better place, because I really fear that this is the way that medicine will be practiced moving forward, and it will be a terrible loss for all of us as people, as physicians, as patients. I think that, as I said, I think we're seeing the worst today.
I know it's such a problem, and because it's so hard, unless you can capture the value, unless you can measure these things that are important, there's a real danger of not being able to adequately value them in the system. Let me pivot a little bit and ask you, I know that when you were, you've worked at a couple of small biotechs in North Carolina, you then worked at another company, small biotech, Tibotech, from Belgium, that was acquired before you joined by J&J. And then when you were at J&J, you did really a lot of incredible work in the area of internal innovation. You founded both the J-Labs Incubator and the J&J Innovation Network, which has offices around the world. What were the differences you experienced in going from a small biotech to a large pharma? And what were your thoughts around how you make, you know, they say, how do you make the elephant dance? How do you make a big, huge company, you know, the Band-Aid company like J&J, be... capture the best elements of a innovative, agile startup?
Everything has pluses and minuses. A biotech company has, you know, as an individual, in a biotech company, you get to do more because there's a lot of needs and not enough resources, and so you're always doing more, which can be thrilling, and that's how you properly supervise. You can learn a lot. You can learn a lot, and you can learn very quickly. A larger company has, you know, tremendous resources to do things that would be very difficult to do in a small company. At the same time, in order to stay large, for a large organization, I think there has to be some quantum physics in this. A large organization demands a lot of its own energy to be dedicated to being large. So while smaller groups of people have the amount of energy required to be of a certain size is small, I think as you grow, the amount of energy, the amount of 100% of the energy that or resources that a company has, a lot more is sucked by just staying together. All right, so I think that is very important to remember, because there are a lot of good things about being big for certain activities.
Like what?
For example, to conducting large phase 3 multinational clinical trials, to prepare for global regulatory deployments, to prepare and execute on global commercialization, on global manufacturing. Those large organizations are unparalleled in their might and in their capacity to do that. They are wonders. They are wonders of civilization. At the same time, those things that make them so strong for some activities make them incredibly weak for others, which is where I would say the ingenuity and the autonomy of the human spirit creating new revolutionary ideas or things.
So would that lend you, meaning that you'd most embrace approaches sort of like these asset-focused companies that like Atlas and these other and several other early VCs kind of have been developing, where they get a really lean team of experienced drug developers around a promising asset or a promising compound, go after it for a short amount of, you know, to get it into the validation stage, and then with the explicit idea that they're not trying to form a FIPCO at the end of the day. They're not trying to form the next Genentech. They're trying to focus on the development of an individual asset or maybe a class of assets at the most. And then if it's successful, they'll wind up absorbed by a larger company that'll acquire them.
I think that's a very rational model, given the strengths and weaknesses of different human communities or organizations. I think that's a very rational arrangement to optimize the use of resources.
Diego, you know, I see so many organizations, big companies, whether they're, you know, pharmaceutical companies, med tech companies, and, you know, even hospital systems, creating these innovation centers, putting really smart people into them, and bearing little fruit often, you know, because despite the great work that may go on in there with company creation or partnerships, the operations, when they turn around and try to, you know, inject those ideas into the operations side, they, you know, they reject the new organ and it doesn't proliferate. Do you think it's possible for these organizations to be effective from the inside or no, it's not?
I have the now. The benefit of experience of trying many different things. So I'm speaking at least from that perspective. I think that small is good for innovation. There's something about small.
Size matters, Diego.
Size matters both ways.
Yeah,
I think for
apparently.
Certain things, small is a more fertile setup.
Well done.
For certain type of human activities and behaviors around accountability, around urgency, about risk, about ownership. I think ownership is very important in innovation, because I think that you need to take it all the way, and it is something that you need to own the downside in order to have an upside. So I think those elements are really those behavioral elements are really important for success in innovation.
So, Diego, now I know we only have a few minutes left here, and I want to make sure we are able to take some of what you're talking about and discuss it in the context of you've recently left J&J after being on a phenomenally ascendant career track to join it's still called a startup, Adaptive Biotechnologies, I think is the name, right? Based in Seattle, though you are personally still based in La Jolla, where you're president of the company, and you are back again in a comparatively, certainly compared to J&J, a small environment. What was your thinking, and what has that transition been like for you?
So I feel, and then this is just me, Diego Morales feels that life has to be made of a collection of experiences. And I felt that I wanted my life to have additional experience. I really felt I had a lot more to experience in my life. And I didn't want, to work for a fantastic large pharmaceutical company to be, the end of my life, or at least the end of my professional experience. So I've always been wanting to go back into the entrepreneurial biotech world with the capacity to apply all the things I've learned. I work for 3 biotech companies. I was in academia as a physician scientist, and then I was in the pharmaceutical company, working from all different, stages of R&D and commercialization. And so I felt that I had an experience that could be applied, in the biotech sector, and see whether we can continue improving that model. So I've always been tempted to do that, and so I had an opportunity in Adaptive Biotechnologies, which is a fantastic company, and they want to apply their immunosequencing platform to improve therapeutics, and to figure out how to use it to optimize therapeutic products. And so for me, that was a great opportunity to create something anew, to create a new group of people that could come together. I love to create teams of outstanding people, and going back to seeing whether we can do something that can make a difference in human health. Still, there's a lot of unmet medical needs, and I felt that it was the opportunity to try to do it this time as a leader of a smaller group of people. And it was a challenge that I've always had for myself, and I felt I didn't want to die without trying it. And so it was difficult. It was difficult because large companies are like being at home. You feel in your home. I mean, you are so it's your family. You are protected. They are mighty. You have tremendous influence and power. So leaving that is hard. It's hard. But I felt that I wanted more of my life. I wanted more experiences. I wasn't done yet. And so it's been thrilling. I am really happy and excited about, living this new life.
What aspect has surprised you the most? If there's has there been one instant where you realize, wow, I'm not at J&J anymore?
I always try to tell myself never to drink the Kool-Aid, all right? And the reason why a lot of people wanted to talk to me wasn't because of Diego Morales. It was because I had a great job in Johnson & Johnson. So I never drank the Kool-Aid. So I always prepare myself in that, Diego, you are going to go back to the bottom because it's not about you. It was about Johnson & Johnson. So I was kind of prepared to be, the last person in the line getting into an airliner and, being in the back, in the middle seat next to the bathroom in the back. I was sort of always preparing myself. So that wasn't the... I would say what has surprised me the most is how happy I am. How happy I am about being back in a world of uncertainty and being comfortable about it. Because one could argue, wow, smaller companies, there's much more uncertainty, which is certainly correct. But I think that in some people, or at least in some stages of our lives, we are more tolerant of uncertainty than in other demands that are required, you know, to be part of a large organization. And so what has surprised me the most is how happy I am doing this.
Well, Diego, that's so wonderful to hear. It's always such a really distinct pleasure to speak with you. I feel like we're just so fortunate to be in work that manages to attract people of your vision, optimism, and substance. And we're so grateful that you joined us on our program today.
I hope we see you soon, Diego.
I'm delighted. I hope we can do it again. It seems like there's a lot to talk about. So I hope we do it again. And thank you guys for doing the great job you do, spreading such great and important ideas and topics as you both do. Thank you.
Wow, I love the guy.
Yeah, I know. Everybody loves the guy. He's so lovable. He's just so interesting. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. I got to do this fireside chat with him on a stage a couple of years ago. And the talk was about wearables and digital health and all that stuff. Now, Diego, if you don't know him, is a crazy long-distance runner. He's the most fit guy on earth.
That's true.
You know, totally strapped and all this fitness stuff. And so we were talking in the...
Easy with the drool, Lisa.
Yeah, right. And we were talking with... talking about this stuff at the conference and about, if people are so fixated on their health, what is their personal, sin? If he's so healthy, he eats healthy, exercises. So what's your sin? He goes, he's a chocolate addict. He told me he was very, embarrassed about it. It was such a riot, just to hear about his professional experiences and then have him have this truly heartfelt confession about his obsession with chocolate. It was quite amusing.
Well, if that's the extent of his confession, he's doing pretty well.
I know. Well, thank you so much for listening today. We will soon be hearing on our next show from Jessica Rousset at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. You can follow David's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
We're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data.
Tectonix is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonix Studio B in scenic Mill Valley, California. Take care.
In the words of Diego Morales, ciao.